The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Hello, Expanse fans, and welcome to episode 4 of season 3 of The Expanse.
Woo-hoo!
Yeah, it's an exciting day. A lot of enthusiasm in the room today. I am Adam Spodersky, the editor-in-chief of Sci-Fi Wire. Unfortunately, my co-host and partner in crime on this podcast, Sherry Martinetti, cannot join us this week, but we will do our best to uphold the grand traditions which she has established throughout this podcast so far.
We will hold the fort.
Indeed, indeed. As always, we are joined by Ty Frank and Daniel Abraham, a.k.a. James S.A. Corey. Say hi, fellas.
Hello. Guys, we're here. I'm here.
Excellent.
I can see Ty, so I know he's here too.
The people behind the whole endeavor that we're talking about. And we have a special guest this week, as usual, but even more special, I think, this week. Cass Anvar, a.k.a. Alex Kamal, the man who flies the Rossi.
Oh, shucks.
and the glue that holds. I'm starting to feel very much now that Alex is becoming the glue that holds this whole little family together. The way things are developing.
They do. They call me Elmer on set.
So it's both. It's that way behind the scenes and on screen.
Yeah, but on set they mean Elmer Fudd.
Do you see what I mean? This is why you have to clear it through me before I do anything with Ty.
We made it literally less than a minute into the podcast before that happened. I just want to make that clear.
And it's the first thing he said. He didn't even say hi. The first thing he said was to diss me. Oh, it's okay. But
so we're here to talk about episode 4, Reload.
Yeah.
A lot going on in this episode, but I wanted to start out from the very beginning because the cold open, if you can call it that, of this episode was really interesting to me, which was the scene of Drummer basically leading the reclamation of the Naboo. Mm. And it was interesting to me because in a episode especially that was very dramatic and had a lot of interpersonal conflict and things like that, this was a very almost serene opening to the episode in that, you know, we just basically got to watch Drummer and her team executing this really cool maneuver of salvaging this giant ship that's floating out in space. Ty and Daniel, was there a method to that? To kind of, oh, you know, what it reminded me of is kind of early Star Trek, The Next Generation, where we had scenes of Riker docking the saucer section and the main section that was actually, you would actually like, that was a thing that we spent some time with as opposed to something that just happened like that. Was there a deliberate, I guess, intention to start with this calm before the storm in this episode?
Well, it was a deliberate decision to remind you that this is still in the world and to spend some time keeping that on your radar. It didn't pay off this episode, but everything that you're seeing with Drummer is aiming towards something later on.
I think there was a little bit. I mean, the payoff for me was that shot of all the drones that were attached firing their engines at once to turn the ship.
Yeah.
I thought that was really gorgeous.
The payoff for me was Drummer looking at the murals in the control room and just sneering.
Yeah, horses and pastures and all, like, the things that Belter loves.
It's like, right? The hell is this?
So that's our opening. But then we very quickly get into a drama-filled episode. A lot of stuff going on at the UN. Anna getting the screws put to her by Ehrenreich, basically.
And Ehrenreich, holy smokes.
Right?
What a snake!
We've basically had every... So Cass, tell us your thoughts on Sean Doyle. We've basically had every episode a different cast member commenting on Sean Doyle and his performance as Ehrenreich.
I love Sean Doyle. He is such an awesome guy. And honestly, every time I see him on screen, and then I think back to every time I meet him, like he came over to the Rossi set when we were shooting one day in like just his jeans and t-shirt, just for no reason but to see us shooting on the Rossi because he wanted me and the rest of the crew. And he is so nice and he's so friendly and he's so smiley and jokey. And you don't see a hint of that in his performance. And I love how you can never tell exactly what he's thinking, but there's always so many plots and schemes going on in his head. And you always know he's kind of like a male version of a corrupted male version of Abba Sarala. He's one of the smartest people in the room and he's always thinking several steps ahead, but it's the dark side, you know? And I just love watching his mind work.
Yeah, it was funny because as soon as he said to Anna, you know, you should be front and center for this, I was like, oh God.
Oh yeah, right?
The sinking feeling just hits that you know that she's just, it's just not going to be a good thing.
This is going to be bad. When, yeah.
And what then was, when Saranda Gillis changed his speech and he kind of just looks at her with that little lizard grin.
Yeah.
Damn.
I guess for Ty and Daniel, when it comes to that scene and that speech and that whole element, are there any, I mean, obviously I think that, you know, the best science fiction kind of reflects the world that we live in a little bit. Were there any things that you drew on in terms of influencing that from the real world?
Just kind of speech writing tricks. I mean, that was the thing that we were looking at with that was how to have this this passage where we've got a long run of a guy talking and still have something change in the course of that moment, you know, have something that where you can feel the speech starting to fishtail under you a little bit.
It was such a nasty turn from this inspiring moment where he's talking about, you know, interfacing with New Frontier and these aliens we've never seen before, and suddenly it just gets really dark really fast.
You can tell which parts Anna wrote and which parts someone else wrote. I mean, and the delivery on it was so nice. I mean, the performance was lovely.
Well, and when the speech changes, Sean as Aaron Wright, he shoots Anna just a little side eye glance. And he his expression doesn't change. He has that same enigmatic smile, but he just kind of looks at her at the corner of his eye to see if she's registered where the speech has changed. And it's a brilliant moment.
Yeah.
It's like one of those things where one of the terms that has kind of come out in political discussion recently is like five-dimensional chess. You know, this person is playing a game that no one else quite understands. And the interesting thing here, I think, is that Anna doesn't even know she's playing a game yet. You know, she's just kind of she's interestingly naive, I guess, about the whole political nature of things. And I think that this episode was a huge awakening for her, especially now that she's got the smoking gun.
Well, and the danger for putting Anna in early was that she would come in and just be Abba Sarala, just kind of act as a surrogate Abba Sarala. And it's important that we have that kind of fish out of water feel with her, that sense that she's actually kind of overmatched.
I don't know that she's necessarily playing it as naive. I think she's playing it as somebody who hopes that they're better than she assumes that they are. She's, you know, she initially came in not wanting to work with the Secretary General, not wanting to write speeches for him, being deeply suspicious of his motives, and being talked into it. And I think she's playing it like she's hoping that maybe he's right. Maybe he is better now. Maybe the system has gotten better, and what's happening here is all of her worst fears are being proven true.
Yeah, and she's just completely unaware that she even has an adversary. You know what I mean? Like Aaron Wright is kind of.
Yeah, Aaron Wright definitely sneaks up on her.
Yeah. I mean, she knows she's in the swamp. She assumes there are some gators there, but yeah, then there it is, the gator.
Aaron Wright sneaks up on everybody.
Totally.
That if you can pull one over on Abba Sarala, then you can pull one over on anybody. Like she's the smartest person in the room, and he still got her.
Yeah, he's outplayed all of the smartest characters on our show. He outplayed Mao. He outplayed Abbasarala. He's outplayed the Secretary General. He's outplayed Anna. Yeah, he's definitely top of his game.
I mean, the interesting thing, I'm waiting for that episode that makes us sympathize with him again. Because I know that's coming at some point. You guys are going to make us hate this guy and, like, want to see him fall. And then there's going to be that moment where it's like, oh, but he's a human being or something.
I can neither confirm nor deny.
Which means yes. So good. Okay. but yeah, no, it's going to be really interesting to see, especially again, now that Anna has that smoking gun, the Access Hollywood tape, such as it is, of the show.
She's got the sex tape.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, it is the one where Aaron Wright screws everyone. So I think that technically.
Good answer, but, man.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see where that goes and what she can do with it. So that was kind of Earth. You know, obviously we're still dealing with the aftermath of the attack the retaliation by Mars, we should say, that killed millions of people. And, you know, a nice little scene between Anna and her wife to kind of remind everyone that happened and the human cost that's going on there. But then a lot happening out in space, man. And now, you know, this is the time when it's great to have Kaz here because we can talk Rossi action.
Mm. Yeah. Mm. And the two Martians finally meet.
I know.
Right?
Yeah. This was a great Rossi crew episode, I think, kind of all the way through. It had a lot of the drama between them, but it also had, you know, oh my God, like that moment where between Holden and Naomi, where they just finally the tiniest thaw, you know, between them was such a relief for after, you know, three episodes of just total frostiness to have that tiny moment. It was like this huge, like, oh my God, I can breathe oxygen again.
Yeah. You know? People always, I mean, when people are talking about the rupture between those two, it's always like whether or not Naomi was right to send off the Protomolecule. And it's really never been about that as much as the way that she did it. And it was good to have that actually said out loud.
Yeah. And I think it's also kind of, they're finding common cause again, you know, now that they have this goal, Holden has put the, you know, jumped back into the fight a little bit, so to speak. And I think that's also a thing that's going to hopefully bring these people together over the course of future episodes. But I think we can all agree that Alex was really the catalyst for the whole reunification of the Rossi crew here.
Well, and an interesting relationship, interesting interaction with Bobby. I mean, that was something I think a lot of people were looking forward to, too.
Yeah, I mean, Cass, do you want to talk a bit about the coming together of the two Martians, the two best-known Martians on the show?
I think it's a really kind of complicated kind of dynamic because Alex has been stuck on a ship with no Martians forever and kind of, you know, swallowing it and listening to everybody gripe and bitch about Mars and this and that and the other thing since the very beginning. If you remember, even in episode one or two of season one, Holden was, you know, busted Mars's balls and Alex was standing up for them. and he hasn't really, because he kind of is not the nationalistic kind of Martian that a lot of the Martians are. He's kind of a misfit on all fronts as a husband, as a father, as a Martian. And so he doesn't really have that kind of footing to be able to kind of stand up and wave a flag, but he still is a Martian. He's still proud of that part of himself. He still has, you know, fond memories of that. And to finally be able to talk to someone else that shares the same common kind of belief and upbringing. And it happens to be one of the most skilled and powerful members of the military that to him, it's like meeting Neil Armstrong. You know, for him, it's like an incredible opportunity for him to meet someone not only from his own planet, but from the military that he has absolute reverence for, because he still really respects the people, whether or not he respects his government and his administration, he respects the people that were in the military with him. I mean, you could see the pain on his face when he is flown through that fight zone and trying to figure out whether or not he knew anybody on those ships.
Yeah, I think
getting to see Bobby is like it's a huge kind of like breath of relief for him.
Well, and I love the scene where Bobby finds out that there was that they actually fought off one of the protomolecule hybrids, and she's like, "Whoa!" You see that first kind of dawning of respect for the Rossi crew.
Yeah. You killed that thing? How the hell did you kill that thing? It's like, right? Yeah.
And I think it's interesting, especially because Bobby, I feel like, is a little earlier along that journey than Alex is of recognizing that, you know, planetary and national allegiances don't mean as much as like shared humanity. Yeah. You know, Alex has kind of come to that place already, and he's created this family with the Rossi crew. And I feel like Bobby's going to get there. She's just still kind of developing that sense.
If that makes sense. I don't know if I 100% agree with that exactly, because Bobby has been in the middle of the political stuff, and she's seen firsthand the deception and the lies, and she's heard it from people's mouths. She beat the crap out of her superior officer to finally get him to admit that they organized a test on her own platoon, on her own team. She's had it in her face. And her disillusionment and her defection and her seeking sanctuary at the United Nations has been because everything she believed in has been ripped out from under her. Well, Alex oh, go ahead.
I was going to say, yeah, I think that the difference between them really isn't where they are on the journey so much as the way that they approach the world. I mean, Alex, at his heart, is a peacemaker, and we've been seeing that all this season. We've seen him trying to mend relationships and to build that kind of sense of shared humanity and to be the one who holds things together. Yeah, Bobby still mostly she shoots people. I mean, that's
yeah. I mean, the biggest indicator of the different way in which the two of them approach the world is in how they lose people. Last season, when Alex lost one of the breaching pods and 25 people died because of that, he turned very inward. It became very much about him and making himself the kind of person who doesn't lose anybody ever again. When Bobby lost her team, she didn't turn inward. She turned outward. She's like, who do I have to kill to make up for the fact that I lost my team? They have a very different way of attacking the same problem.
Yeah. And it was the other great Martian moment, I guess, for Bobby, especially this, although we're jumping ahead a little bit here plot wise, is, you know, the crew rescues this team of survivors from the Martian ship, and they take Alex hostage.
Mm.
So, Kaz, you got a little action in this episode.
Yeah.
It was mostly just getting your butt kicked.
Hey, I got one good shot in there.
That's true.
Did you not see that?
Yeah. Kaz, I remember when you insisted on that.
Hey, man, I can't just keep getting my ass kicked all the time without –
how many ships have been blown up now, Kaz?
Yeah.
I think you kick ass plenty.
Amos is going to have taught him some moves. He's going
to
have taught him
but
some
moves. But it did hurt to watch that one guy just pounding Alex.
Oh, my God. Kick my face.
Oh, it was painful. Later on when Holden says, the only thing you've done so far is hurt Alex's pride. I'm thinking,
Alex's pride.
I'm pretty sure he hurt something else, too. Soft tissue damage along with the breath.
Alex calls his pride. All you did was hurt Alex's pride, by which he means you pounded on his face.
Yeah, right. That's the moneymaker, you know.
Yeah.
Touch my face. Don't touch my face.
But so, for Kaz, was there when you and, you know, Frankie finally come together as the two Martians on the Rossi crew, was there a coordination? I mean, we talked a little bit about this with Frankie last week, like a coordination ahead of time about what are Martian mannerisms like and what are, you know, kind of finding a common ground before the scene?
No, actually, I mean, what for me, what was the most important thing? We didn't talk about that. I mean, we've talked about that actually for the past couple of seasons. Even though we had never had a scene together, we'd always see each other on the set, and we'd always hang out and talk in between scenes, and we'd joke around. But we'd always kind of like talk about Mars and kind of have this kind of like, oh yeah, bloody earthers, oh yeah, goddamn belters. And there would be kind of like this joking camaraderie that we were slowly evolving over the years, just in the rehearsal process. And so we didn't really actually do any of that. What for me is the most interesting part of it is like Frankie, her personality as a person, she has this really unique, interesting kind of personality that she's just totally affable. She's totally approachable. She manages to just kind of like embrace you just by being present. And for whatever reason, her and I click really, really well. We joke around and we click really well just as people. And I noticed that when we started doing the scenes and we kind of just, you know, we tweak our characters from our personalities, and that chemistry carried over into the scene work. So there was always kind of a little twinkle and a little tongue in cheek kind of smirk between us that I think was, it's just really, it's something you can't really plan. And it's a really nice way to kind of bond these two characters together with that kind of like chemistry. But it's because they're from the same planet, you know what I mean? And they share a common culture and they share a common history that they all know about. And now they're all isolated off in space. And so they this is the person that they talk to.
That was a nice little moment there that came across very well in the scene in the gym.
Oh yeah,
at the end, where she busts on Alex's
my what?
His form.
Yeah.
His belly that. Prosthetic. The prosthetic right. Belly that we have to add to Kaz.
Mm-hmm. It's okay.
Did we lose it after that? Was that the last time we saw the prosthetic belly?
It was, yeah.
All right.
And he's gonna hit the gym.
Oh, there you go. This is
gym now, Bobby, give him a workout routine.
Yeah, I hope people don't consider that too much of a spoiler. Alex is losing the gut.
Yeah. We had talked at great length about having Alex develop some sort of eating disorder where he just kind of kept getting larger and larger and larger throughout the... See, Kaz didn't like that.
Until he doesn't fit in the chair anymore.
I like the idea that he starts stress eating and he just keeps getting bigger.
Yeah.
Especially in space, because it's not like you're eating actual, like, good organic foods out there. Yeah.
Of course it's organic. It's organic yeast. You built it right there.
Yeah, I was going to say. There you go. Yeah. Organic yeast and fungus.
Yep.
Yeah.
From the tubes right there.
But so, and actually, it's kind of a shame that Cher is not here today because Cher has had some things to say about Alex's arc this season.
Like what?
Yeah, no, because obviously in the first few, and you know, we're jumping around a little bit and we'll get back to this episode in a second. But in the first couple episodes, the last episode and one previous, we got some really deep moments for Alex in terms of his message.
A lot of polarity on those responses, I have to say. I've been looking at that. There's a lot of sympathy and then there's a lot of anger.
Yeah. In terms of his relationship with his wife and children.
I was surprised by it. It's legit. I mean, it's real and it's authentic. But I'll be honest, I was surprised by it. So that was actually quite interesting. I liked it.
Yeah, so can you talk a bit about, I guess, having to give that speech that is the message home to his wife and kids, and how you kind of bring, I mean, because it is a tough situation, you know, he's an absentee father but I said one of the greatest tricks the show pulled is that it makes us really like Alex a lot in, you know, two seasons of stuff before we get that moment. So I guess, can you talk a bit about that monologue and what it was like?
Absolutely. I mean, it was a tough one for me. It was when I saw it, when they wrote it and I looked at it, I was kind of like, oh shit, this is a big one. Cause it ended up being about two pages of dialogue that they told me they wanted to put kind of a montage over of all what everyone's doing around the ship. While I'm speaking, but they wanted a big chunk of it to be just me giving an email to my wife. And when I saw that, I was like, holy crap, this is about as raw and vulnerable as a human being can get. And, you know, he's not even talking to anybody. He's talking to a camera. So I embraced the challenge. I really liked it. I actually worked with the writers on tweaking a little bit some things, because I had to make all these big transitions within that speech, and then come up to that finally, that thing where, like, I was a crappy father and a worse husband moment. And ultimately everyone came together and supported me to help me get that. And the most brilliant moment was when Breck Eisner, our director, we had already shot a few takes of it, and you know, they were fine. And he goes, you know what? He says, don't know you're gonna tell her that. Just make the email to check in on them and see if that they're safe, because the war's broken out and your family could be under fire. Just check in on them and realize it just before you say it. Mm. And I was like, fuck yeah, that's a great choice. And so we did another take of that. And so it just hit me, like, I'm just there, hey guys, make sure you follow, do what your teachers say, follow your mom's instructions, be safe. I love you guys. I don't love you and everything. And then all of a sudden I was like, Jesus, why am I here in this ship? Well, you guys are out there worried for your lives. I am a horrible, horrible husband. And it just hit me like a ton of bricks. And that ended up being the main take that they used for it. And I was so grateful for my directors, for Breck's input on that. He really kind of guided me to a very authentic thing. And then I hear from a lot of military people that I saw on my feed. There's a lot of soldiers that watched that and said, dude, that's exactly the conversation I had. I can't believe you captured that military conversation experience so real and so painful. And I had a couple of them actually text me about how it just resonated with the whole military experience being on deployment.
Oh, wow. That's really interesting.
And that was very rewarding for me, because to be able to give something to those people out there who are putting their lives on the line and sacrificing so much, and let them feel heard and let them feel understood, that's a big deal. And that makes me feel like, you know, this I have some purpose in this world, to be able to in some small way alleviate some people's suffering, or at least make them feel understood.
Wow.
There you go. I got deep.
No, that's great. That's great. I did that. Actually, never occurred to me that is kind of the same conversation those people would have. That's really interesting.
Yeah.
So which was the bigger challenge, that, or where you have to deliver this monologue basically to a camera, or where you have to receive the response and basically react to it wordlessly?
They were both hard, man, because both of them are things that I have some familiarity with in my own personal life. So I kind of drew on that, and it was painful. One thing that was kind of fun is, because I know the girl who played my wife, I knew her, she's a friend of mine, and she's actually, I've worked with her on another show as my wife. And so we were very close. And I asked her if she had already filmed her side of the speech. And she goes, no, I don't. I said, because I'm going in to shoot my side of it now. And I said, is there any way you could, like, just tape record it for me and send it to me? And she was, I just woken her up. Like, she was, like, groggy and half asleep. And she was, oh, okay, it's going to be kind of groggy. And I said, no, just send it to me. And so she recorded it and then emailed it to me. And I listened to it so I could hear what she was going to be saying to me. And then we go to set, and we start doing it. And when you're doing one of these scenes, you don't have the actor there. The lines are usually read by your first AD or someone on set. So I think it was Joel that was reading them. He's a very funny guy.
That's a very different read. Having Joel be your wife. I mean, he's a great guy.
He was either
like
Joel or
six-foot-five hockey player guy.
Yeah, that's a very different emotional place to come from.
Yeah. And so we did a few takes of it. We were okay. And then I kind of like pulled my phone out because I had it beside me. And I said, can you do me a favor? Can you just play this when it comes time? And he's like, oh, okay. And so we shot another take, and he hit play, and I heard her voice, and I got goosebumps and I got chills. and I just listened to it and I just reacted to that. And it was just like that. That was what I needed to hear, because it changed everything. And it was a very, very painful moment to be told, we don't need you anymore. So yeah, I think the first one was a little more painful because Alex had to kind of rip open something that he had not even looked at, really seriously, and admit something. The other thing was just a reaction to him that he was kind of expecting. He was hoping it wasn't going to happen, but he was expecting it.
Yeah. One of the things I love about Alex is that, his tragic backstory is so human. Everybody else has this, you know, kind of superhero origin story.
Yeah.
And Alex is something where half people in the audience know that guy. I think it gives him a power. I think it gives that character a power.
Well, especially I think when it comes to the relatability amongst all the other members of the crew. I mean, again, that's so far this season, that's been Alex's biggest, I mean, other than, you know, that emotional moment, I feel like has been his biggest role, is kind of as the starting to try to glue things back together.
Yeah. Well, it's so important to him because he lost his family, right? He left his family back home and he's lost his planet. He's lost his everything. And he's found himself in the seat of the Rocinante, and he's found his new family, and they belong with him. And there is nothing more important to him than that. There is nothing in the universe more important to him than this new family. So he's going to do whatever it takes. He'll do anything to keep them together, because it's life and death for him.
And I think that having that moment with his old family, with his wife and his kid, be the lead in to him making peace with Naomi, having him be the one who says, oh no, really, actually these relationships are really important. Oh, right. It lends a depth to him that I'm pleased by. I'm glad it worked.
Yeah. I kind of admire him because he, it's an ironic thing he says to Naomi when he says, I wish I had your strength, because he's kind of beaten down on himself for not having been there for his family. But for somebody to be able to admit how big they have fucked up, how badly they have messed up, the painful, honest truth that you know, it is not something he is proud of, that requires a level of maturity and self-reflection and introspection and strength that very few people get to that point, you know, in their life. It takes a lot of courage to do that. And I don't even think Alex realized. I think he still thinks of himself as a failure, at least in terms of his family. And I don't think he really appreciates how much he had to work and grow to get to that point. Because if you remember in seasons 1 and 2, Amos and Drummer and Naomi, everyone asked him about his family, and he just buried his head. He just ducked him. He ducked every question. You know, he didn't want to deal with it.
But so I think, and it was really interesting with Alex in this episode. I was so ready for the objection to salvaging the Martian ship to be a plot point. And it was interesting to me how he just kind of was able to express it and then move on. I thought that was a distinctive thing for the show. Yeah. Let's talk about that whole subplot of the Martian survivors. I mean, that's not a book element, right? That wasn't something that happened in the books.
Nope, we added that in.
Can you talk a bit about the impetus behind adding that whole plot for this episode?
Well, part of the thing is that we want it to be an issue that the Rocinante is not an infinite supply ship. It's, you know, they do run out of supplies. They do run out of rounds. They do run out of fuel. They do have to find some way to make money. And this was one way, you know, kind of just the very early version of this was one way to have that be part of the world, have it be something where, no, actually, this is a tenuous thing, even though we have this ship.
They can't just turn the replicators on or anything?
Turns out, no, that's not a thing. We are not a post-scarcity show. And part of what's scarce in this is, you know, munitions and ways to kill other people. And since we're going to be doing some of that, maybe it would be good to have something in the clip. Not a bad thing.
I love that about the show. I love the realism. Like, we don't have unlimited supplies of torpedoes and unlimited supplies of bullets and unlimited supplies of laser banks and shield generators and all that stuff. It's like it removes a huge jeopardy from your survival when you take all of those threats away and all of those challenges away. And it adds a whole element like that, just the way Bobby reacts to us. What did she say? Stripping the graves or stripping the dead. Like, there's this whole just morality to it that just comes from a pragmatic, practical reality of, like, we're running out of ammo, you know, in a war zone.
Yeah. So there's that element. But then also, obviously, we had the whole thing with the survivors and them taking Alex hostage and the standoff on the bridge. Obviously, a very cool moment. I mean, my favorite part of that has to be when Bobby shows up and everyone's just kind of like, whoa.
Oh, never mind. This is over now.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, what does he say? Like, she could, that's a recon uniform. She could make you eat that gun if she wanted something like that. That was an interesting shift in the dynamics of the scene. But I guess, Ty and Daniel, in terms of the origins of that aspect of this subplot, what was that? I mean, cause to me, one element of it is it seems like it brought the crew together a little more. Was that kind of the motivation behind having that in there?
Well, in the book, the Rossi gets resupplied by a Martian destroyer. And there's no threat to it. It's just sort of they join forces with a small Martian fleet, and the Martians just give them more missiles. So in the room, we talked about creating a moment where we get the same effect, where the Rossi gets resupplied, but adding some threat to it, adding some danger to it. You know, they're in a war zone. Earth and Mars have been pounding on each other for some time now. And how can we get that resupply moment while still having it be dangerous? And that's the solution that we came up with, was this, you know, finding this graveyard of ships and getting the resupply that way.
Yeah, and part of this is that the war as it plays out in the show is a little different than how it plays out in the book. And so you kind of do have to stick to the reality of the context that you're in. You have to take the way that we have portrayed the Rossi being something that the Martians would totally simply take back if they got hold of it, and express that, not just have, you know, not have the version of it that we had in the book if it doesn't fit.
Yeah, we'd never want to lose track of the fact that the Rossi, from the Martian perspective, the Rossi is a stolen ship, and they want it back.
And that's much more pronounced in the show. Yeah.
Yeah.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but I can't recall a scene in any season that our captain got into a fist fight.
No, right?
Well, yeah, I was going to ask. Miller choked that guy out.
He does.
We got to see our number one, our fearless leader, actually go to the wall and get into a throwdown. And I think that was really cool.
Where did Holden learn his jujitsu? That was a pretty sick move he pulled.
Well, Holden does have military training. I mean, he was in the Navy. But and Steven has a Steven's not somebody you want to mess with. He's
a black belt. I think he has
several black belts. I think he has multiple black belts. Yes. Yeah. And the thing that I thought was actually kind of the bravest about that whole thing was that, like, for the rest of the show, he's going out of that horrible nose, plum nose.
That was beautiful.
It was great. You know, it's like hit in the face, and then that looks like it probably hurt. Okay.
Yeah. You just need to keep coming up with every few episodes some reason for Holden to keep getting hit in the face so that it just stays that way for the entire run of the show.
Mess up that pretty face.
You can get it tattooed.
We do like to beat up our cast, because I think this season, more than almost any other season, everybody's going through the episodes with bandages on their face and And even Anna, you know, even we bring beautiful Elizabeth Mitchell in, and the first thing we do is hit her in the face.
Yeah, it's true. We did that. That's a thing.
It's a rite of passage for the cast.
Apparently so. I don't know. Did we ever hit Dom in the face? I don't think we ever hit Dom in the face.
No. But we give her those horrible bruises on her chest and neck.
We do some awful things to her. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. No, later.
She got
beaten up.
But what was I going to say? Something along. The funny thing was, though, this episode, the person who gets the least action is Amos.
Yeah,
right.
You're waiting for that moment of him to bust onto the bridge and just like house everybody, and then you get a laugh line out of it. But
he still has the best line in the episode.
Oh yeah, yeah. That's two episodes in a row because he had the line about the heels in pumps.
Yeah.
Last episode, so
good one.
Wes is racking him up, but I'm hoping at some point this season we'll get to see Amos unleashed a little bit.
I can neither confirm nor deny.
There you go. Yeah, that's the answer I was looking for. And no. I think the other interesting thing about the whole standoff scene was that it drove home the allegiance of the crew to, and the fact that I think one of the big points being that there aren't the two sides in the war aren't basically Mars and Earth. They're like the people who want chaos and violence and stuff like that, and the people who don't.
Well, that's one of the arguments that we make in the books a lot, that no side is monolithic, any side that you choose is going to have hawks and doves and people who want to find a peaceful solution and people who want to kill the enemy and that it's possible and kind of better to have those connections happen across factions when they can.
Yeah, and I mean, just obviously we've got a whole hodgepodge of people on the Rossi at this point and all on the same side of maybe people shouldn't be killing each other indiscriminately. So that's nice.
It's a weird argument, right?
Yeah, weird. I know. It's strange. So before we move on, because there's one other scene I want to talk about, one other element of the episode that I do want to talk about, but I just wanted to, Kaz, for you, I guess I've kind of asked everyone who's come on so far this question without giving specific spoilers away. What would you say is kind of Alex's theme for this season, or what was the main thrust of for playing the character this season for you?
Family is a huge one in all of its manifestations. Him kind of taking responsibility for the choices he's made, and not pussyfooting around or dilly dallying or being wishy washy about it, which he had been and which he struggled with in the first season and a half, where you know he wasn't exactly sure who he was, he wasn't exactly sure how he fit in, he didn't exactly know what his purpose was or what they should be doing, and then everything kind of like circumstances that they've been thrust into have basically galvanized everybody and put them and have sent us all in different directions. That's what's so amazing is that the same circumstances have sent all of us onto different paths. And Alex's was on one of enlightenment and self-discovery and taking responsibility for himself. And I think once he let that penny drop, then he basically every step, he's a very simple guy in many ways. Once he knows who he is and what he's doing, every action he takes, he tries to make it fulfill what he believes in, which is keeping that family together. And then when his family, in any sense of the word, is threatened, taking actions accordingly.
Do we get to see him pull more dope like pilot maneuvers?
Oh boy. Let's just say he's practicing in a parking lot.
Yeah, I was going to say for you, like as the pilot of the ship, how obviously you don't get to see while you're doing it what the end result is going to be. So what's that kind of like experience for you when it comes to
these? Oh, I love it. Battles? It's say what?
When it comes to these big space battles, like
It is so incredibly fulfilling because obviously the directors, they kind of like grill it into our heads while we're sitting in those chairs, what's going to be happening in the VFX side of it. And so you're trying to fantasize about it, imagine it, what it's going to be. And then you act your little face off there doing all the high G burns and the juice and the space battles and everything like that. But then to be able to finally get to see it, and it's so incredibly rendered. Our VFX team, kind of our world builder in that area, Bob Monroe, they have created such amazing graphics and effects. Like even the one from the episode 2 weeks ago where they did that missile attack on the UNN ship. Just beautiful, artistic, elegant, realistic kind of space shots. It's so rewarding. I get goosebumps whenever I see it. I've actually gotten to see a few scenes from the latter part of the season. And some of the stuff that you guys are going to get to see, man, it's breathtaking.
That's awesome. Did you have to train yourself not to say like pew, pew, pew and things like that?
No, I don't do that. That's Amos. That's Wes. Wes is the pew, pew, pew guy.
Because I've seen that's like a recurring theme on a lot of sci-fi shows and movies. I think there was that shot of Laura Dern from The Last Jedi where she's shooting her gun and she's saying pew as she's shooting it. And you can actually see her mouth moving. So.
Well, because all you got is a dead gun that's not doing anything, right? Yeah. And it's like, and then you're like, in your mind, you're imagining the sound and it's not making a sound. So you make the sound. Or even when you're punching someone and you're not getting to hit anyone, so you're like, poof, you're like creating the sound effects. So yeah, that's a little actor. It's a little actor faux pas that we all have to get over.
But it's out now. Wes is the official culprit.
Yeah, Wes is the best. He gets the best blooper material. Like I have to say, I'm jealous. I don't appear too often on the bloopers. Wes gets all the best blooper stuff.
All right. Well, and then to end on a much darker, horrific note. we obviously have to touch on Io and what happened there in this episode.
Oh,
because
man.
Holy crap, that last scene.
I'm sure it was totally ethical doing that with a child actor. Not a problem at all.
Oh my God. I didn't know. I didn't even know until I saw it. Like, I didn't know. I saw these photos of those props, and I was like, what the hell is that for? And no one really told me. And then I saw it, and I was like, holy crap, what did you guys do?
Yeah, so just for those listening at home, recapping, we're talking, of course, about, I forget his name, Katoa, obviously going through his transformation through the proto-molecule, literally tearing his nurse apart into little tiny pieces and cataloging them very neatly on the floor.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he needs to know where everything goes so he can put it back together.
Yeah.
Exactly right. Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, it's like a cadaver lab where you missed like the one first step. Other than that, it's exactly the same.
Sure. Except done by a child.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
The kid
with his bare hands.
Yeah, well, you know, he's precocious.
He's got the one part about that scene I thought was so great was that how that drew it out, you know, because obviously we don't see that reveal until the very end, but those guys are in the room with that from the very beginning of when they enter the room.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just such a great reveal of that shot pulling back and seeing all those pieces laid out, and oh my God, the body horror.
I feel like if May makes it, she's going to need some, psychological little couch time.
I'm thinking a little couch time.
I think she might get some PTSD.
It seems likely. And then my friend ripped the guy apart.
Did May see that?
May totally saw that.
Jeez,
yeah.
Man.
I mean, on the other hand, you know, kids are tough.
You guys are awful. you guys are horrible.
So was that that's pretty graphic for even for a non-premium cable show. Was that a tough sell at all?
Nope.
No, right. Actually, in Canada, you're allowed to kill actors.
Yeah.
So, it was really nice. You didn't even have to build a prosthetic.
Yeah, so that actor was actually torn apart, and those aren't props, is what you're talking about.
Yeah, that's why everybody shoots in Canada.
Now, that's a guy who couldn't remember his lines, and I had in season one. we got him back just for this.
Yeah.
There actually is, I think, a dead guy we got back for this season, but he's not in yet. We'll talk about him later.
That's true.
No, the idea here was just was to really draw a line between the disassembly that Katoa does and the disassembly of the Arbogast on Venus.
Right.
The idea of all of these things kind of being part of the same story. And we do some body horror. That is a thing we do.
And really giving Mal motivation to continue the project. Because we see him second guessing it. We see him sort of having that crisis of conscience. But we also know that his only concern is figuring out what's happening on Venus.
That was another one of those moments that you guys do where it's like, oh, look, he's having a change of heart and maybe there's goodness in him after all.
But the first time we found out, we really saw him was when he was hearing about Julie being dead. He was crying in that scene. I mean, when he found out his daughter had died and was saying to move forward with Eros, there were tears. You can go back and see him. He's always had that double nature of being both human and subject to human emotions and dedicated to this project and what it can mean. I mean, that's part of what makes him an interesting character.
And so just for my clarification, the hybridization process that they're going through with these kids now is different from the ones that created the kind of the Project Caliban.
Yeah.
Like hybrid monsters that we saw.
Yeah. It's not really explained at length, but I mean, Strickland does talk about the fact that the old hybrids had to have a command and control thing with an explosive in it because the hybrids always eventually broke down control and tried to get away, and then we'd have to blow them up. What he's saying is with the kids, he thinks he can make hybrids that last forever because of the genetic disorder these kids have. So it's sort of stage two of the same program. Yeah. So all the hybrids that are in those pods that they've got outside are the old version one hybrids. Now they're trying to create the version two hybrids.
But it seems like the impetus, at least for Mao, is less about let's create these soldiers or whatever and more about now I want to be tapped into what's going on Venus, yeah, right?
That's right. If it was just about soldiers, he would have ended the project. He's seeing is that connection to Venus that he thinks will allow him to really solve the protomolecule.
Yeah, the Mao's take with the making soldiers, that's always been how you monetize it and get the governments to back you. Because they're kind of short-sighted. They understand military things, and they understand weapons. Eros was about understanding what this thing is and what it can do and what the limits of it are. And it was a much larger vision. The thing that Dresden was talking about before Miller killed him wasn't we will make a better kind of tank. It was, we will remake what humanity is from the ground up. Mao has always had a much grander vision for what this thing could be and what it could do.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the two scientists we've seen, you look at Strickland and you look at Dresden.
Yep.
From season two, you really see the spectrum of what people hope to get from the protomolecule. Strickland is looking like, look, we can make these soldiers and they're awesome. Dresden had the much grander vision of we'll remake ourselves, we'll become a whole new humanity, we'll have all these, we'll conquer the stars. And I really feel like Mao is on the Dresden side of things. I think Dresden was spouting off what Mao's vision of it was. Strickland is much more of an engineer. He's much more of a technician. He just wants to solve one problem. He doesn't have sort of the big vision. But once Mao becomes aware of the fact that Strickland's engineering solve may actually be the key to solving his much larger problem, then that's when he really gets on board.
All right. Well, that was episode 4, Reload. So yeah, that was a lot of stuff going on. And thank you guys so much for joining that conversation. I think we can move on to our shout outs now. As listeners know, we go around the horn and kind of shout out something that we're into at the moment. So I don't know who wants to start.
Well, I do want to say this podcast was the best one we've ever done. Did we change something? Because this one went really well.
I'm not sure.
No comment. No comment.
You know she's in the room.
It was Cass. It was Cass.
Clearly, that was it.
There we go.
But
credit where credit is due.
That's right. We'll be back to full strength next week, and for better or worse.
Oh, I see. You are dissing a little share there. That's not good.
But it is consistent. I mean, it's very.
Well, from what I hear, she's going to give me an earful about Alex's life choices. So maybe I'm a little happy about this particular arrangement.
Maybe we'll have you back before the end of the season.
Okay, yeah.
Just for that, we'll do a special bonus episode. It's just Cher like berating you for Alex's choices.
She's going to, oh, man.
No, but all right. I don't know who wants to shout something out at this time.
A friend of ours, mine and Ty's, who's also writing space opera, Walter John Williams, and I've just gotten the proof of his new book, The Accidental War. He did three books a while back in something called the Dread Empire's Fall series. It's the Praxis. What are the other two? The Praxis, The Sundering, and Conventions of War. Yeah. And now he's coming out with a new book called The Accidental War in the same series. Haven't read it yet, but I'm really love that series, and I'm glad to see it's coming back out.
Oh, that's great, because I just finished a book. I just finished Space Opera, actually, which was
The Cat Valente. Podcast.
Yes, so now I will just jump on another one of your recommendations.
Awesome. Start with the first one. They're great, and there are more coming out.
Very cool. Ty, do you have anything?
No, I've been working pretty nonstop for the last couple of weeks. I haven't done anything fun. I will give a shout out to my wife, who just did her Viva in England, and her PhD committee ended by saying, "Congratulations, Dr. Frank." So I think that means it went well.
That sounds like it. Yeah. Unless they were just trolling her, I don't know that if they do that, but yeah.
Not at Cambridge. The university is 800 years old. They have no sense of humor.
They're pretty serious. Well, that's great. Congratulations to her. That's awesome.
Yeah. So now she gets to be Dr. Girlfriend.
I think Dr. Wife at this point. I think she can be Dr. Wife. And actually, I got to read some of her PhD. Thesis, and I know that PhD theses are not usually the things we shout out here, but she's talking about how designers approach the decisions that they make and the underpinnings of the design process in a way I've never seen any. I mean, my mom's an architect. I've been around this stuff since I was a kid, but I've never seen anybody do the kinds of work she's doing on this. It's really awesome.
Yeah, and she's an architect and an engineer, so she's approaching design from that architect-engineer perspective and how those designers make decisions. It's very technical and complicated.
And I'm just an engineer fanboy. I know like a third of what I'm looking at there, but it's really interesting to see.
I was going to say, it sounds like sorcery to me a little bit. I'm with the technical things, I'm not so good. So, yeah.
Yeah, well, part impressive. Of what she studies is how you control people's behavior with design. So she is actually an evil wizard.
Except she's good. Other than that,
right? A good evil wizard.
Yeah,
I think that's a alignment, right? Good evil.
Sure.
Something like that. How about you, Kaz? Anything you're into at the moment?
I got two things, both of which, if you really listen carefully, you'll realize they're shamelessly self-promotional for myself. However, they are actually really interesting. I just shot a movie with created by Veena Sood. I don't know if you guys know who Veena Sood is. She's this amazing voice, writer, director voice. She created the series called 7 Seconds and on Netflix, which is an amazing, amazing series, which I would encourage anyone to see. And then she also wrote and directed this film that I was in, which is, I think, temporarily titled Between Earth and Sky with Peter Sarsgaard. So my first shout out is to Vina Sood. I think this woman has an amazingly powerful voice. She has a lot to say about racism and racial equality and inequality. And the movie I just did really has like the undertones and the power of a movie like Crash. And the other thing I was going to give a shout out to was the International Space Development Conference. We get, ever since I just joined The Expanse, I've been and we've been invited to all sorts of really amazing science and space related events, like Yuri's Night, and we got invited to the Caltech panel that we did there, the Science of the Expanse at Caltech, and then another one that we did at another space organization. So apparently the International Space Development Conference, the ISDC, is one of the biggest and most prestigious space conferences, and it's going to be going on May 24th to the 26th. There's all sorts of really cool guests that are going to be there, and they're going to be talking about space exploration and colonization and all the most current and recent technological advancements in space travel and colonization. And I think like Buzz Aldrin's going to be there and a whole bunch of other really high profile guests. And The Expanse has been invited to do a presentation there on the 25th, which we're all going to be on stage and talking about the science aspects of The Expanse. So see how I did that?
Well done.
That's very cool.
Yeah. That's like, do you shout out / shameless plug.
Do you guys find that you have a particularly large following proportionally in the space science community?
Oh, yeah.
Well, they seem to appreciate that we have tried to hew close to some of the basic physics. So it gets us some points.
All right. And my shout out is a musical one. I'm not actually going to sing it, but I'm shouting out Janelle Monáe's new record, Dirty Computer,
nice.
Which came out in the past week and is phenomenal. And just a great, great record for our times. It's a lot about her identity. And, you know, she came out right before the record dropped as, you know, she calls herself pansexual. And, you know, talking a lot about the experience as a queer person and as a person of color and a woman of color. And it's all in the record in this, but also in this like really awesome pop soul package. You know, it's like if you really listen to it, there's a lot going on there, but it's also incredibly catchy and danceable and great. So
nice.
I'm a huge Janelle Monáe fan, and please check out that record because it's awesome. So thanks you guys for joining me. I know we were shorthanded, but I think we pulled through.
I think this is our best episode.
Ty is on record as referring this episode to all others. But and thank you, Kaz, so much for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Awesome to have you. And thank you to everyone listening at home. Please rate and review us on iTunes. It really helps. Recommend us to your friends. Subscribe, all that fun stuff. And check out Sci-Fi Wire's other podcasts, Strong Female Characters, The Fandom Files, Who Won the Week, and The Colony Podcast, which I believe launched its next season this week as well. So thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you next week for episode 5.
Woo-hoo!